I'm Rose, and I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank Mike for asking me to come here this weekend, and I'd like to also thank the committee and all the people who have greeted me and treated me so nicely, and my husband so nicely, and your hospitality and generosity have been so appreciated. I've been having a great time, and I hope everybody else is too. I'd also like to thank the speakers, the rest of the speakers that I've heard so far this weekend. It's been phenomenal hearing what you have to say, and the way that you carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous has really touched me. I'd like to welcome those of you who are new to Alcoholics Anonymous and let you know that when I was new, what I found in Alcoholics Anonymous was hope. I came here completely desperate, dying from alcoholism, and not knowing what else to do. And I sat in rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got hope. I got hope that there may be an answer for me. And as I stayed in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and did what you people told me to do, I found a solution to my problem. And that's what I'll probably end up sharing with you tonight. My sobriety date is December 19th, 1985. My home group is the Serenity Gals Monday morning 10:30 a.m. meeting in Thousand Oaks. I have a sponsor. My sponsor has a sponsor. And I say those things because I think that that's very, very important for me to have a sobriety date, to keep that sobriety date, to know where I'm going to be each day, and to know who I'm going to be accountable to. I'll just run the basic deal here. I better keep track of the time. And tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like for me today. I'm the youngest of five kids, and I was raised in an upper middle-class family in Westlake Village. And I am the only alcoholic that I know of in my family. I remember very early on, from a very, very early age, the earliest I can remember, feeling uncomfortable. You know, I was restless all of the time. Felt like my skin was on inside out. You know, that all the nerve endings were on the outside, and the wind would blow, and I just would shiver. I was uncomfortable constantly. And never really fit in. Never really a part of. Always feeling different and separate, and I was irritable, and I was full of fear and shame, and I was angry and always thinking that something was wrong with me. Always had my eyes turned inward. And I was constantly discontent. You know, I was one of those kids that thought, you know, if I just lived at so-and-so's house, I'd be happy. If I was just a boy instead of a girl, I'd be happy. If I had blonde hair and blue eyes, I'd be happy. And just never content. I suffered from that perpetual malcontent feeling all the time. And so I was restless, irritable, and discontent long before I contemplated a drink, long before I took a drink, long before I even knew what those words meant. I was uncomfortable. And, you know, I remember, you know, the type of family I come from is my dad's a workaholic, and my mom's very controlling, and you do whatever she tells you to do, and when... You know, when we would get in trouble, she'd say, you know, just wait until your father gets home. And so it'd be 2 o'clock in the afternoon, you'd have to wait till 6, till he walked in the door, terrified because you knew you were getting in trouble. And she'd just let you dangle out there in terror, you know. And then we'd all sit down around the table and she'd say, do you know what your daughter did today? And he'd be like, why is she my daughter now? You know, why when it comes out? And then he'd be resentful that he'd have to, like, you know, bring down the discipline. And so you'd get some, like, gnarly thing, like, okay, you're grounded for 6 months, you know. And then he'd go back to work the next day, and mom would just let you go off and do whatever. And there was no consistency whatsoever in what she said and what we actually ended up having to do. And another thing about my family is that everything is always okay. You know, if it's not okay, we don't talk about it at home. If you're uncomfortable, if you feel something other than happy, we're not discussing it. And so I had no ability in which to, I had nobody teaching me how to handle those feelings of restless, irritable, and discontent. You know, I'd cry about something and my dad would say, "Why are you crying?" And my mom would say, "You shouldn't cry. Don't let it bother you," you know. And I always got all these mixed messages from very early age. Heard that I shouldn't feel the way that I feel, you know. That whatever is wrong with me, it's got to be something within me, because you know, if you were a good girl, you wouldn't cry. And so I kind of learned very early on to shove that stuff down, you know. So by the time I was 7 years old and a friend of the family sexually abused me, I wasn't going to mom and dad with that kind of stuff. You know, I was shoving that stuff down. And I blacked out at that point. I have no memory from the time I'm seven till the time I was 12 years old. No memory at all. No memory of birthday parties. No memory of Christmas. No memory of anything. And the next recollection that I have in my life is that my parents moved us from Westlake Village to Colorado, and my dad worked there, and his company wasn't going to be flying him home every weekend, and so we had to move there. And we moved there, and I met my best friend who lived around the street, and I was 12 years old, and she had a boyfriend who was 18. Don't ask me how that happens. I have a 13-year-old son right now. I can't imagine him dating like some 18-year-old girl, but this is what was going on at the time. And at the time in Colorado, the drinking age for a certain like 3.0 beer or something like that was 18. And so this guy and one of his friends decided he was going to take my girlfriend and I to a drive-in movie. And we got in the back of this truck. You know, they turn it backwards and you got the screen in front of you, and they pull out an ice chest full of beer, and I was about to take my first drink of alcohol. And my parents don't drink. There's no alcohol in our house. I've not seen anybody drink, get drunk, or anything like that up to this point. And I take my first drink of alcohol, and it consists of a six-pack of Michelob and a can of Foster Lager. And you know, I'm 12. I may be 75, 80 pounds at the most. And what happened for me that night before I got deathly ill was was I drank that, and all of a sudden my skin flipped the correct direction. All of a sudden I felt okay, and I felt a part of, and I was comfortable, you know, and it didn't matter what happened in my past. It didn't matter that my parents were, you know, 40 years old when they had me, and I, you know, I felt like they were the oldest people in the world. Now that I'm 44, they don't seem old at all. But you know, when I went to school, all of my friends' parents were like young, they're playing tennis. My parents, I'm like the last of five. My oldest sister's 16 and a half years older than I am. You know, my parents are tired by the time they have me. There was no tennis, beach, there was nothing like that, you know. And so, you know, I've got all these feelings of shame of who I am and where I come from and things that have happened to me. And all that went away when I drank that beer. And then what amazingly happened to me after that, which is what ended up happening to me for the next 10 years that I drank, was I got violently ill. Violently ill. And I caught some kind of a stomach flu and was violently ill with the stomach flu for 7 days from my first drink. And it never registered at all to me, well, you know, I probably should not drink alcohol. It never, ever registered to me at all to do that. What I did come up with was, I'm certainly never going to drink beer again, ever. That was horrible. And I, you know, and for the next 10 years, the only time I ever drank beer was when there was nothing else to swallow a Quaalude with. That was it. I mean, because I wasn't going to swallow Quaaludes with water, because they don't work as fast. You have to swallow them with alcohol. So that was the only time I kept that promise to myself. I was just not going to drink beer again, and surely that was the problem. And that was not the problem at all. What happened for me was I did exactly what the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous talks about in Chapter 3. You know, I switched from beer to hard alcohol, didn't drink it in the house, only drank it at parties, switched from scotch to wine, whatever. You know, I did the deal, and every single time I drank, I took the first sip, my skin flipped the right way, I felt a part of and comfortable, and then I got violently ill at the end, every time I drank. And I don't know about you, but, you know, any normal person would probably think, drink alcohol, get sick, don't do it anymore. I, however, figured it's part of the deal now. It's just, it's like when you go to the gym and you're sore the next day, it's just part of the deal, right? I mean, it's just part of the consequence. And so I rationalized that getting sick and throwing up every time I drank, and I would always pass out. I would get sick, pass out, or pass out, come to, get sick, whatever. But I always drank to excess. I always drank to oblivion. I always drank to blackout. I always drank to pass out, and I always got sick. And that just became like part of the deal. That was just part of the consequence. I didn't contemplate ever not drinking. So I kind of did that type of behavior, and I was brilliant. By the time I was 16 years old, I was convinced that I no longer needed to go to school and that I was going to be a successful drug dealer. And I stopped going to high school. I took the equivalency test or the GED and stopped going to high school at 16 years old. You know, it never dawned on me that one day I'd be a 44-year-old mother with two children and I'd have to help them do homework. You know, it never dawned on me that one day I might possibly need to know how to spell above an eighth grade level, you know, or maybe have a vocabulary of an adult. And because those things were never important to me, because what happened for me when I took that drink was I found the ease and comfort that I had looked for or yearned for or wanted my whole life. And when I found that prescription, I would do anything to get it. And so I, you know, took up that new job title of drug dealer and quickly became my best customer. And what happened was by the time I was 18 years old, I was convinced that it was really where I lived that was the problem. It was where I lived, which was still at home, by the way. And and you know, we meant it back then, but we used to say, you know, Westlake Village, where I now live, is we used to say when I was young, you know, it's for the newlywed and the nearly dead. And and I'm back there, and I'm not a newlywed. So I knew that was the problem. You know, Westlake Village was the problem. And the day I turned 18 years old, I moved to Santa Barbara, and I moved into a one-bedroom apartment with two of my friends from high school who actually completed high school and decided to go to college, like responsible adults. And so they were up there attending college, and I moved in with them into a one-bedroom apartment, and I packed my little Toyota Celica with everything I owned, and my mom's like, okay, you're leaving, and she didn't think I was really leaving. She said, here's $25, and kind of like, I'll see you when you get back on Sunday, you know what I mean? And I never went back. I never moved back home, and I drove up there, and you know, they threw a little party for me when I got there, and amazingly enough, the same thing that happens every time I drink happened then. You know, I drank and I passed out and came to and got sick, and then the next day, with a severe hangover, I circled the ads in the Help Wanted in the newspaper, and on Monday I went for a job interview, and on Wednesday I got the job and I started working, and that was it. I was a grown-up. And no one was going to tell me what to do anymore, what time I had to be in, how I was going to live. I was going to do what I needed to do. And I was thoroughly convinced that this was going to be like the best thing that ever happened to me. Strangely enough, standing here today, I can tell you it is the best thing that ever happened to me. It seemed like hell at the time, but it is the best thing that ever happened to me. I remember sitting in that apartment one day, one evening, and my girlfriends came home from wherever they were, and they said, "You're never going to believe who we ran into. We ran into so-and-so from down south, and he's coming over with a couple guys, and we're going to have a party." I said, "No problem," and I had already started on my half gallon of, I think it was called Jacare wine. It was like one of those wines that it was pink. It probably had no grapes in it at all, and it was a screw-off top. And I had, and it had like the little handle, you know, you had to be really careful when you poured it, kind of a thing. And I think I was drinking that out of a plastic cup. And I had already taken one of the two Quaaludes I had bought for the day. And I said, "Great, have them come over," you know. And so these four gentlemen come over that I don't know, and I don't even really remember. And I've completed my bottle of wine for the evening, and I have to do my regular routine. It's time to get sick before I pass out. And somebody's in the bathroom, so I'm standing in the kitchen, and I turn the sink water on, and my roommate says to me, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm going to get sick. But I got to get sick because I can't get sick, you know, later. I got to get sick right now." And she said, she's mortified. "You can't do that. We're having a party. We don't barely know these people." And she finally gets the person out of the bathroom, and he watches me run in. I throw up. I go in my room and pass out. And the next day, he calls me for a date. Now, that should have been a red flag for either one of us, but it was not. And it wasn't a red flag for him, and it certainly wasn't a red flag for me. And he asked me out on a date, and I thought, what the hell, you know? Why not? It didn't occur to me. You know, the man's 11 years older than I am, and he's just asked me out after watching me completely, you know, demoralize myself. And I don't question his judgment at all. At all. So I proceed to go out with this man, and I date him. And, you know, by the time I'm 18 years old, I want you to know that I am a daily drinker. I have to have other substances in my body as well. It's painful to wake up in the morning to think, "Oh, my God, I got another day to live in this skin," you know, and so it's all I can do to get whatever I need to get into my body, to show up to work, to pull myself through another day of this miserable life and existence that I have, because by the time I'm 18 years old, I am a complete piece of crap. And I have totally mastered that pitiful and incomprehensible, demoralizing stuff that we talk about here. So I go ahead and start to date this man, and I'm starting to circle the drain. You know, I'm starting to circle the drain. It's getting harder and harder to recover from the hangovers. It's getting more and more difficult to hold down the first couple of drinks. I'm throwing up sooner. I'm worse off than I was before, and I just am losing any little tiny shred of self-esteem or self-acceptance that I have left. And by the time I'm 20 years old, he asks me to marry him. And I say yes, not because I'm in love with him, but because I'm such a piece of crap, I figure I'm 20 years old, who would ever want me? And so I say yes. And I never knew I'd be married three times, but I at the time I thought that was my only chance, you know. So I say yes to this man, and we moved from Santa Barbara up to Monterey, California. And it was in Monterey, California that I hit my bottom and dragged that man along with me down the drain. I'm the type of alcoholic that I have a lot of really good intentions. And the problem is that my intentions and my actions never match up. My intention is to, like, show up for work. My intention is to be home when I say I'm going to. My intention is to pick you up at the airport when your plane arrives. My actions are the complete opposite of that. And so I continue to disappoint you, and I continue to disgrace you, and I continue to feel more and more like a piece of crap and deplete any little pilot light that's left of self-esteem. And I'm the type of alcoholic that I keep thinking that because it's a new day, that something different is going to happen when I take the same action. And so I get this thought in my head, and it kind of runs like this. It's 5 minutes before I'm supposed to leave to come home from work. I'm going to stop by so-and-so's house on the way home. I'm only going to be there for a half hour. After a half hour, I'm going to come home to my husband, make dinner, clean up those dinner plates, go to bed on time so I can get up on time to go to my job in the morning. That is my intention. I truly, to 100% of my being, mean that to myself and to others. I go to so-and-so's house. I take that first drink of alcohol, and all intentions that I have go out the window, and the actions that I have are that I stay there and I have one more, and just one more, and just one more, and before you know it, it's 12 hours later. And that person that loves me more than I love myself, that's sitting at home, that's worried, that doesn't know where I am, that is frantic because he thinks I might be dead somewhere, I give absolutely no consideration to that person whatsoever. I haven't even thought about him once since I took that first drink. Not once. Never even enters my mind. And 12 and a half hours later, when I have to go home, I'm forced to go home because the person's house that I'm in finally says, you've got to go home. I'm one of those people who, like, stays forever. You know, I'm the guest that comes and never leaves. So short of throwing me out of their home, which, by the way, I have been thrown out of many homes before, I have to go home. And as I'm driving home and I round the corner to where my house is, I see the police cars in front of my house. And for a very brief moment, the truth tries to come into my mind, into the consciousness of who I am. And the truth is, oh my God, you've totally blown it. You are in so much trouble. And I feel just a second of fear. And immediately, right next to that, parallel to that thought, comes into the lie, the alcoholic thought. And that thought is, I'm a grown woman. I don't need anybody to tell me what to do. He can make his own goddamn dinner. And I get that chip on my shoulder because my fear is so uncomfortable, I got to replace it with anger. So by the time I stomp up the stairs to that apartment and I fly open the door, and the cop says to me, you know, ma'am, your husband was worried about you. He didn't know where you were. My response isn't, I'm so sorry. Please forgive me. My response is, well, I'm here now. You can stop worrying. And I have to go throw up. So, you know, it was at that point where when I came to that next day, and that was the first of many nights thereafter that man slept on the couch. When I came to that next day, it was the first time ever that I thought to myself, you know, maybe I have a problem. Because up until then, my attitude was always this. It's my body. I'll do what I want to it. I'm not hurting anyone else but myself. If you had my life, you would drink too. It was always about me. It was always a constant thought about me. It was always about how I was being affected, how horrible things were for me. If you only knew how it was, you know, that kind of deal. It was always about me. I never, ever, ever once considered you. And for the first time, I thought, you know what, maybe I have a problem. And so I'm not really sure where I got the information, but I called a 12-step program, and I called them up, and they said, There's meetings by your house. Do you have a piece of paper? I write down the meetings. They gave me a meeting to go to every day, right by my house. And I hung up the phone, and I turned to that man who was so angry the night before, who had called the police, who was so worried. And I said to him, I think I have a problem. And I called these people, and they said that I need to go to a meeting every day, a 12-step meeting. And he said to me, it's not that bad. Just stop drinking. I'll watch you, and everything will be okay. You know, and God bless that man. I wished he could have watched me and everything would have been okay, and I'm sure he wished he could have watched me and everything would have been okay. But like the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous tells me, no human power can relieve me of my alcoholism. And so that man watched me. I couldn't have, of course, I couldn't not take a drink. I was already at a point in my life, and this is about a year and a half before I got sober, I was already at a point in my life where I didn't want to drink anymore now. And I still had to take a drink. Up until that point, I wanted to take a drink. But now I was at a place where I didn't want to take a drink. And it never dawned on me that if I set my mind to it and decided I wasn't going to take a drink, it never dawned on me I wasn't going to be able to do that. It never dawned on me. I thought, fine, I'll make a decision. I won't drink. He'll watch me. I never thought that that was going to be impossible, but it was. And so I was at that place in my life where I was living to drink and drinking to live. I didn't want to drink. I shouldn't be drinking. God, please help me, don't drink. And I still took a drink. And so for the next year and a half, I went down the drain. You know, I circled and circled and circled and went down the drain. And we had moved back to Santa Barbara at one point, and my husband was working out at LAX, and so he was living at my parents' house in Westlake during the week, and I was living up in Carpinteria and working, and it was 5 minutes before it was time to get off of work. And I had this idea. I'm going to stop by so-and-so's house for a half hour, and then I'm going to go home, I'm going to make dinner, I'm going to clean up those dinner dishes, and I'm going to go to bed early so that I can go to this job that I have to show up for tomorrow morning. And I really meant it with every fiber of my being. That was my intention. And so I stopped by so-and-so's house, and I had that first drink of alcohol. And for the next 4 days, I remained in the same clothes that I had worn to work that day. I did not sleep. I did not eat. I did not bathe. I became a monster, basically. I was not the little girl that my mom and dad raised. I had, as Mike was sharing, I had no idea where those principles had gone. And I sat standing 4 days later in this apartment. Back then, they didn't have voicemails, so we had, you know, machines, you know, answering machines, and the little red lights flashing on the answering machine. And, you know, at this point, I can't talk to you when you call, and I certainly can't call you. And the last day and a half, I can't even get out of the apartment just to go to the AM/PM at the end of the street to get another pack of cigarettes. But I've already smoked all of my cigarettes, and I've already dumped them from the ashtray into the trash can. So if I'm now digging through my own trash, straightening out the cigarette butts, trying to light them. Remember, it's 1980. There's lots of hairspray. 1985. Trying to light them without setting myself on fire. And I'm standing there in pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, and I want to die. I want to die because one more time, my intentions and my actions don't match up. And I'm just an empty shell of a human being. And I'm completely desperate, and I don't know what to do. And as I'm standing there, I have a moment of clarity. And for me, what a moment of clarity is, it wasn't like I did not hear God's voice, no big lightning thing happened. What I got was a truthful thought. And what that truthful thought was, if you don't pick up the phone and call somebody right now, you're going to do this again. And for whatever reason, because I had done this behavior, the get the thought, you know, get the desire to drink, take the drink, set up that phenomenon of craving, drink through a spree, however long that spree is, emerge from that spree remorseful, swearing to never do it again, and then doing that same thing over and over and over again, I knew that if I didn't pick up the phone right then and there, that I was going to do it again. And so I picked up the phone and I called my parents' house where my husband was. And I said, I have been up for 4 days. I've spent all of our money. That means the checks that we've written are now going to bounce. And I don't know what else to do. So they said, well, can you drive down here? Yeah. I'm thinking, where's the sanity in this? They want me to drive. But yeah, I can drive down there. So I drive down there, and I remember walking into my parents' front door. My mom's not speaking to me, you know, because it's a bad thing, and we don't talk about that. And I look at my dad, and I say, please don't be mad at me. And he says, I'm not mad, I'm just disappointed. And that look on his face, you know, this is the man that I had up on the pedestal. This was the God in my life, you know, and that look of disappointment on his face, if I had anything left, any self-esteem left, it just crushed it. And that was December 18th, 1985, and the next day was my first day of sobriety. And my parents were desperate. Like I said, there's nobody in my family who's an alcoholic, at least nobody who admits it, and so they didn't know what to do with me. So my sister said, well, let's call her therapist. So they called the therapist, and the therapist said, bring her in the morning. And so my parents brought me in the morning, and I want to paint the picture for you of what I looked like. I'm 22 years old. I was probably about 25 or 30 pounds lighter than I am now. My skin is gray. My eyes are yellow. I'm dressed in all black. My hair is, like, falling out of my head. And I walk into this man's office, and I sit down with my parents, and I'm there no less than 5 minutes, and he says, I can't help you. He said, I believe that you're an alcoholic and a drug addict. You need to go to a hospital. There's nothing I can do for you. If you'd like to come back and see me after you get detoxed, I'd be more than happy to work with you. But you need to go to a hospital. And my parents said, well, we're not leaving here until you find some place for her to go, because she's not coming home with us. Like, we don't want her either, you know, like, don't stick her with us, because she's a nightmare. And so I went into a hospital program, and in Van Nuys, California, beautiful Van Nuys, California, right there on Van Nuys Boulevard, and that was like a step up for me, because you know, the places I had been and the things that I had to do to drink and use were certainly in much worse places than Van Nuys, California. And I checked into this hospital, and I had absolutely no idea that, like, it didn't register to me. I'm an adult. I can walk out anytime I want. I just thought, I'm there. I have to stay. And I didn't know I had an option to walk out. I didn't know that I had an option to say, I don't want to do this anymore. I just was at the end of my rope. I had tried everything else, every way in which to stop drinking and using. You know, a year and a half before I got sober, when I said I had a problem, I tried to stop, you know, and what happened for me was the feelings were so uncomfortable that I was not able to keep them down, and I started suffering from anxiety attacks, and my husband would rush me to the emergency room, and they'd shoot me up with liquid Valium and send me home with Xanax and Ativan, and then I would drink. You know, and I know what that's like. They talk about that in the big book. They talk about Bill, you know, taking sedatives and drinking and really going crazy. I went there. I did that. So walking into a hospital in Van Nuys was like a step up for me. And so I went into this hospital program, and they detoxed me. I was in detox for 4 days, and then they took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember walking into this room and thinking to myself, this is not what I thought it was going to be. You know, I'm expecting, like, old men in trench coats with brown paper bags, and I walk into this meeting, and it's at a place called Radford Hall, and it was in North Hollywood at the time. And they, you know, they, like, sat all of us patients together, and the guy who took us there from the hospital leaned over to me and he said, at the end of the meeting, they're going to ask for volunteers to help clean up, and you should raise your hand. And I said, help clean up what? And back then, you know, every meeting was a smoking meeting, so they had these tin ashtrays. You had to clean the ashtrays out. They had regular, you know, porcelain coffee cups. You had to wash the coffee cups. You had to stack the chairs, that kind of stuff, sweep the floors. And when he described to me what I had to do, I thought, you got to be kidding me. Like, I don't do that. Now, remember, 4 days before that, I'm so desperate, willing to do anything. If you told me when I walked into that hospital, now what we want you to do is push this nickel down Ventura, or, you know, down Van Nuys Boulevard naked with your nose, I would have done it. 4 days after detox, my ego's already rebuilding itself, and I am above emptying an ashtray and washing a cup. Sold my soul and everything else for drugs and alcohol out there, but I'm above stacking some chairs in an AA meeting. And he said, I highly recommend you do it or you'll probably take another drink. And you know what, for me, that's all I needed to hear. I was just afraid enough to not want to take another drink. So at the end of the meeting, I raised my hand. And so in this hospital, what I found out was that I suffered from a disease called alcoholism, that I wasn't the piece of crap I thought I was. I wasn't a bad girl. I was sick. And that if I wanted to, that Alcoholics Anonymous had a solution for that disease, and I could work this solution, and I could keep my disease at rest, in remission, if you will, as long as I followed a few simple rules. And I didn't have to think twice. I was like, I'll do whatever I have to do. They told me that I suffered from an abnormal reaction to alcohol, a phenomenon of craving, they called it. And it made total sense to me why once I took the first drink, it didn't matter what my intentions were, what my plans were, that this phenomenon of craving took over and that that first drink took the second drink for me. And the third and the fourth, and that's why I couldn't stop was because my body had an abnormal allergic reaction. And that's what made me different from my fellows. And that abnormal reaction would never, ever, ever go away. Ever. You know, it's like the person who's allergic to bees or the person who's allergic to peanuts. If somebody's allergic to peanuts, I guarantee you that person, every time they sit down, if they didn't make whatever they're about to eat, they say, are there any nuts in here? Okay. Me, on the other hand, I'm thinking tiramisu. Is that the one that has the alcohol in it? Can I eat this? I don't know. You know, like never occur. Allergic reaction. If I'm allergic to penicillin, I will always be allergic to penicillin. If I'm allergic to alcohol, I will always be allergic to alcohol. And I'm not so sure why I got that early on, but I did. I understood physically what was wrong with me because they explained it just that way to me. And they said, unfortunately, you have a twofold disease. And the other half of that disease is that you have an obsession of the mind. And if all you had was this allergy of the body, you could stop drinking and then you could just go on your merry way. But the problem is that for an alcoholic like you, you don't get to just stop drinking because you have a mind that can't remember how bad it was. And it'll eventually get you to take a drink again. And that obsession of that this time it'll be different, or this is how I'm going to do it, or next time I'll only drink this, or I promise I'll show up, that whole denial that goes on in my head, that obsession is going to get me to take another drink. And then I take the drink and the allergy takes over. So they said that what Alcoholics Anonymous affords me is an opportunity to work on that obsession of the mind, because that is something I can change with my disease. And that the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are designed to change my thinking so that I don't have to go ahead and believe the lies anymore, so that when the truth wants to come in, I can hear the truth, I can take action on the truth, and if a lie tries to come in, I can go ahead and recognize it as a lie. That my perception will change as a result of working the 12 steps. And so I go, you know what, okay, I'm totally willing to do this thing. Totally willing to do it. So I do this 28-day program. They take me to all these meetings and stuff, and they tell me that they highly recommend that I go to a meeting a day for my first year of sobriety. I'm thinking, again, here's that ego. A meeting a day? I mean, don't you think that's a little extreme? And they said, well, you drank every day, right? Yeah. You lost your job as a result of drinking? Yeah. You don't have a house anymore, a home to go to. Your husband has had to move out of your apartment and into your parents' home while you've been in here having, you know, three meals a day. Yes. You don't have any friends left. Correct. What the hell else do you got to do? A meeting a day for your first year of sobriety. Okay, so I'm like, okay, all right, I'll do it. So they said a meeting a day for first year of sobriety. They highly recommended that I get a sponsor. I didn't really know what a sponsor was, but I thought, well, if they're recommending it, like the guy who recommended I raise my hand to clean up, I'll do what they tell me to do. And so I asked this woman called Michael Lynn to be my sponsor. Didn't really know anything about her, but she was one of the people who worked at the hospital. And she said, yes, she'd be my sponsor. So I got that down. Okay, I have a sponsor. And they said, they highly recommend that I get a commitment at one of these meetings that I'm going to go to. And that the meetings that I go to, I should go to the same meetings every week. Like if I go to a Monday meeting, a women's meeting, I should go there every Monday, and so on and so forth throughout the week. And the reason that they recommended that to me was because they said how important it is for me to be able to go ahead and to start to meet people, to have a fellowship grow up around me. Since I had no friends, and the friends I did have were friends they highly recommend I stay away from, and that they told me that I needed to change everything about myself, that I needed to start to get to meet new people, and that by going to these same meetings every week, that those people would also get to know me. And that it would be easy for me, if I'm going to the same meetings, to get a commitment at one of those meetings. And so I did that. So I got out of the hospital, and I got this woman I call sponsor, and I'm ready to go to these meetings every day, and I get a commitment. I think I was, the first thing I was a greeter. And I'll tell you what that commitment did for me. First of all, it got me to show up. But what it really did for me was it got me to a place where by taking action that I wouldn't normally take, by doing something that is completely foreign to me, that's contrary to any thought I would have in my mind, as I welcome you into the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I start to feel better about myself. So I start to feel a part of. And then I feel like it's important for me to be there, because if I'm not there, there's not going to be anybody greeting at the door. So now I have a purpose in life. And then each week that I do that, I start to meet the same people. Like, instead of me saying, hi, I'm Rose, they say, hey, Rose. And I say, hey, John. And I start to make some friends. So now I'm feeling a part of. I feel like I got a purpose. I'm excited to go someplace. There's somebody who's I'm going to know when I get there. And so just a little tiny bit of my self-esteem starts to come back. And so I start to like this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, it's starting to work for me. And I'm managing to stay sober. And things are going good, going to meetings every day. Got this woman I call a sponsor. And all of a sudden, I think it's probably a good idea to let the ex-husband know that I'm no longer in love with him. I'm 45 days sober at the time. and not really that I'm no longer in love with him, but that I really didn't love him at all. And because there's no way possible I'm going to be able to live a lie and stay sober. So here's this man that I've drug through just utter crap with me. You know, in the muck and the mire of our, you know, bottom. And he's now living at my parents' house because I lost our house for us, our place to live. And we have no money because I spent all that. And I say, by the way, thanks for supporting me through this hospital treatment and all, but I need to get separated. You know, they tell you don't make any big decisions in your first year of sobriety. There's a reason for that, because you really don't know what you're doing, and you really damage a lot of people during the process of all these big decisions you're making. So so he's devastated, and you know, and he goes. He leaves. And I proceed to spend the next year and a half of my sobriety going to meetings every day, going to every dance, every convention, dating, getting into, you know, AA relationships and going to coffee after meetings and having my commitments and doing all of the peripheral stuff that we do in Alcoholics Anonymous, all the fellowship, all the unity, all the service, doing all that stuff. And I get into this relationship, and I'm about a year and 4 months sober, and you know, they say the quickest way to work the steps is get into a relationship, and and I get into this relationship, and it's not good, and you know, he starts the process of leaving every few months in this relationship, and each time he leaves, that self-esteem that I've built up by going to meetings and having my commitments and stuff like that gets to deplete some more, and deplete some more, and deplete some more, and I get to that point, I'm a year and a half sober, and I'm desperate, feeling restless, irritable, and discontent. And all of the things I've been trying, you know, the shopping, the sex, the food, none of it's working. I'm not finding any ease and comfort. And I'm on the edge. Don't know how close I am to actually picking up that drink, but I'm on the edge. And my sponsor, I got a different sponsor, and she says, I think it's time for you to do an inventory. I haven't even, like, worked the first three steps, but we're going straight for the fourth step because you're a sick girl. And so she says, here's a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and read these pages and then do the inventory and get back to me. Okay. So I, you know, I've done nothing up to this point at all to change my thinking. Nothing whatsoever. All I've done is put the plug in the jug. All I've done is stopped the phenomenon of craving, which can be done very easily by detox, in case anybody cares. So I went ahead and I read that section of the big book. It's very clear. If you look at it, there are three columns. I go ahead and I write a three-column inventory. I don't realize there's like other pages behind that. I just read that section where it's, you know, written out there, three columns. Okay, done, three columns. It was very easy because, you know, I always know who I'm mad at. And I always know what you've done to piss me off. And I'm very, very clear on how that affects me. Very clear. So I write this three-column inventory, and I go to meet with her to do my fifth step, and she realizes that I really don't know what the hell I'm doing. And so she says, well, you know, I'll help you along. You read it to me, and I'll write what your character defects are. Because let me tell you something, guys. If you don't do a four-column inventory, the fourth column, by the way, for any people who have not gotten that far yet, is the column where you take a look at what your part is, okay? Which is where you will find your character defects, which are the things that, for me, run my life, that cause the damage in my life and in yours, and eventually get me to take a drink. Very difficult to find those if there's not, that column's not there. So I'm reading to her, she's writing, she hands me this list of character defects, she says, come back next week, and we're going to do your amends list. Okay. So I've completely skipped 6 and 7, run straight into step 8, write a list, she's written it out for me, these are the people, great, perfect, go to it, and I start on my 9th step with no direction whatsoever, just go make amends. So I go out there, and of course, you know, I'm one of those people, I will do the least amount possible and expect the most results. That's who I am. So it's very important that I first go to the people who are going to love me no matter what, you know, family members, mom and dad, okay? I'm going to go to those people, and because I'm not met with much resistance, that wasn't so bad, if I'm sorry, you know, okay? So I think, okay. Now, mind you, I am, at this point, I'm a slow goer here in this program. I'm like almost 3 years sober. I start this process with my sponsor at a year and a half because I'm in so much pain. The guy I'm with, he's like left me 50 million times by this time. I keep going back. And so with each time I put in a block of self-esteem by doing something esteemable, like a little bit of writing on my inventory, he leaves me and the block falls out. And so I'm left still this empty shell of a person. I'm almost 3 years sober. And I decide it's time to make amends to the ex-husband, the first husband. And the 45-day I don't love you anymore husband. And it never occurs to me that I haven't spoken to this man since I was 45 days sober, and I'm almost 3 years sober. And my idea is I'm going to show up at his work. He now has moved to Santa Barbara. God, I hope he's not in this room. And He's now moved to Santa Barbara, no, excuse me, to San Diego, and I'm just going to show up to his work because I got to make amends. Because, see, it's all still about me. Nothing's changed. It's still all about me. And my sponsor, thank God, she had some wisdom. She said, I don't really think that's a good idea. Maybe what you should do is write him a letter. And I think, why would I write him a letter? She says, it's very possible he may not want to see you. That never occurs. What do you mean he's not going to want to see me? It's me, for God's sakes. And she says, just write the letter. So I write the letter, and a week later, I get a response back, and I open it up, expecting, yeah, yeah, come on down, right? And I open it up, and it says, wow, 3 years sober, good for you. Can't imagine there's anything you could possibly say that I'd ever want to hear. Don't bother. And I thought, oh. Well, it says, somewhere in that book, I read it, it says, if you try to make amends and someone throws you out of their office, water under the bridge. So I throw it away. Okay, I did my best. But I'm not going to make any more amends because that was like way too painful. Just stop right there. Go directly into step 12 and start sponsoring people because I have all of the answers now. And I'm going to live this happy life in AA. Woohoo! Okay, so I'm strolling through life, still doing all the outside stuff, man. Still, like, have not really gotten an inch closer to any higher power. Nothing. Complete self-will run riot. Complete out of control, untreated alcoholic. Still doing the dance of death with who becomes husband number two, okay? And I am 4 years and 9 months sober. And I'm sitting in a meeting on a Friday night, and this man is sharing from the podium. And one more time, just like that night when I stood in that apartment and that little red light was flashing on the phone machine, just like that night, I'm sitting in that room and I get a moment of clarity. And then remember, that moment of clarity for me is just the truth, an honest-to-God thought, a true thought. And the thought was, if I do not walk over to that man when this is over and say, please help me, I'm going to die. I know I'm going to die. I'm going to take a drink. So after the meeting, I walk over there. And I'm, as you can tell, I'm not the most humble person in the world. So I walk up to him and I say, listen, you know, I think I might have a problem. And he says, well, what are you doing? And I immediately go down the whole litany of all the commitments I have, how many meetings I go to with the girls that I sponsor, la, 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 la. And he says, you know, I don't know if you're aware of it or not, but in Alcoholics Anonymous, we have an emblem, and it is a triangle with a circle around it. And that triangle has three sides. And one side of that triangle is unity. And that is the fellowship. That's the body of the program. That's where you go to bring yourself to a place where people suffer from the same thing that you suffer from. And it sounds like you do that, Rose. It sounds like you do the fellowship and you have a body, the body part of this triangle going on. And he says, on the other side of this triangle is the service side. And that's where we go and we give away what we've been so freely given. That's where we do our H&I stuff. That's where we go ahead and we do our commitments and that kind of stuff. And he says, the bottom of the triangle, however, is the mind. So you got body, spirit, mind. The bottom of the triangle is the 12 steps of recovery. That's where you get the change in your thinking. And it's the bottom of the triangle that kind of holds the other two sides up. And I highly recommend that you take those 12 steps or you're going to drink and die. And I'm thinking, wow, he's extreme, this man, you know? Sheesh. I said help, not lecture, okay? So he says to me, what I can do is I can take you through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and work the steps for you. You need to be at my house at 9:30 every Sunday for the next 9 months. Again, I'm thinking, 9 months. That was like that go to a meeting every day for a year, which, by the way, I probably did that for like my first 3 or 4 years of sobriety. But I'm thinking, that's a long time, 9 months. Completely in denial over the fact that I've got a hole in my gut bigger than the one I came into Alcoholics Anonymous with. The problem is I have an ego at that point bigger than the room itself. And I'm thinking, 9 months, 9 months to save my life, 9 months. Not sure. And I, because I didn't want to look like a fool, I said, okay. So I showed up at his house 9:30 on that Sunday, and I'll tell you what that man did for me. He sat down with me every week, and we read the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous page by page, word by word, and had to look up the words I didn't understand, which, let me go back, okay? Eighth grade vocabulary, lots of words need to be looked up. And he took me through all 12 of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. The most amazing thing was that I really got in touch with the powerlessness of my disease, the powerlessness over alcohol, and the unmanageability of my life, because I hadn't taken a drink in almost 5 years, and my life was so unmanageable, just as unmanageable as it was when I first got here. And for some reason, by sitting down and going through that part of the book with him, it almost like illuminated it. It opened my eyes up to the reality and the truth of what was really going on in my life. And I got to see through my actions and my reactions to things, even in sobriety, how insane I was. How every time I thought, I'm going to do this again and it will be different this time. In every area of my life. And how that if I would come to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to some kind of sanity, some sane thinking. You know, I'm thinking insanity, straitjacket, rubber room, okay? I'm not thinking a lack of proportion of the ability to think straight. But that's what insanity is. That's what the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous defines it for me that way. A lack of proportion of the ability to think straight. And so I have to make a choice. I got to decide. Is God everything or is he nothing? And I don't have really much of a relationship with God up to this point. But it was so terrifying for me to think that God was nothing. Do you know how screwed I am if God is nothing? And my only choice is everything or nothing. There's no like choice C. There's no, you know, in certain situations maybe. There's nothing. All or nothing. And so out of fear that I don't want it to be nothing, I choose everything. And I make a decision to turn my will and my life, my thinking and my actions, over to the care of this something that I don't understand. And the way I seal that decision is I move into a fourth step. Surprisingly enough, I've come to find that not only are there four columns in that inventory, but there's also three sections of that inventory. There's a fear section, sexual conduct harms unto others section. Didn't even read that part. That, by the way, is much more uncomfortable to write about than the resentment area. And I do that inventory, fearless and thorough. And I write down all of those things I'm completely ashamed of. And I do a fifth step. And as a result of doing that fifth step and making sure that those first four steps are done properly, I get the promise that they share with me at the end of that fifth step, which is that I'm going to be able to walk through this archway, a new woman to freedom. And I don't get any, like, you know, no lightning bolts happen, no burning bush, none of that, but what I get is a sense of belonging, a feeling that I've earned my seat in Alcoholics Anonymous, that I can finally participate in my Wednesday night step study meeting when they talk about steps other than step one. And I find out from doing that fifth step that I have quite a number of character defects, as some of the girls that I sponsor will tell you, because I take out that list, and then I go ahead, and when they're reading me their fifth step, I'm taking character defects off that list to help them write theirs, and they're like, whoa, man, what is that? You know, it's like a two-page list of character defects that I have. And I was given the direction to go home and find a quiet place for an hour with that list, and make sure that I've done everything I've done up to that point, to the best of my ability, I've left nothing out, to thank God from the bottom of my heart for all that he's done for me and that I am here to know him better now, and contemplate what on that list I'm not so willing to let go of. So I'm thinking, you know, I don't really know if I want to let go of this control thing because that still seems to work for me. It may not work for anybody else I'm trying to control, but it seems to really work for me. So I put a little tick mark next to that one and next to the one, I believe it was rigidity, that know-it-all, lack of humility, you know, insensitiveness, inconsiderate. Because I'm not so sure I want to, like, change those things. And so in my sixth step, I get the opportunity to ask God to give me the willingness to have those things removed. And I'm reminded that in step two, I made that choice that God is everything. And so if I ask him for the willingness, he's going to give it to me. And so I have to act as if by moving to step seven. And in step seven, I go ahead and ask him to take away all of those things, good and bad, that stand in the way of me doing his will. And I get back with this list, this eight-step list. It's surprisingly enough, by the way, husband number one is still on the list. And I'm married to husband number two at the time. And I want you to know that husband number one does whatever he does for a living, but for a hobby, he is a photojournalist for Surfer and Surfing magazine. And since I made that attempt to make amends to him and was refused, up until the second I'm standing there with that new eight-step list, every time I pass a car with a surfboard on it, every time I see the ocean, every time I'm in the grocery store or a checkout stand anywhere and there's a Surfer or Surfing magazine, anytime I see a granule of sand, I have that feeling in my gut. That discomfort that I want to push away somehow. And so here I am faced one more time with an opportunity. And so I have to respect the fact that the man does not want to see me, so I'm not running down to San Diego. And I write a very humble letter. And I say, I understand you do not want to hear what I have to say. However, I neglected to mention that I believe I owe you some money. Half of what I spent of all of our money. I'd like to pay that back to you. I can't do it all at once. I'm wondering if you'd be willing to let me make some kind of payment arrangements. A week later, I get a letter and it says, if this is what you need to do so that you can feel better, feel free to send me however much money, however often you want, and live your life. Amazingly enough, there's still this man out there who loves me more than I love myself, who's willing to go ahead and let me have an opportunity to pay him back so that I can feel better. And so I start the process. But here's my deal. My second husband's in the program. And I immediately, like I told you before, I want to do something, the least amount of effort gets the most results. So I go home and I say, what I'd like to do is I'd like to take the, however much money it was, off of the credit card, cash advance kind of thing, and send it to him immediately so I can get rid of that icky feeling, and then that would be good, right? And my ex-husband, my second husband, who's also my ex-husband, he says to me, I think you're missing the point here. First of all, it's to make amends except for when to do so and injure them or others, okay? We're already in debt. Not a good idea, cash advance, okay? And the point is that you're supposed to write the check every month so that you can remember the living part of the amends. You can remember what it is you're doing. It was a lot of money at the time, and so all I could afford was $25 a month, and so I wrote that check every month, every month, every month. 2.5 years into this amends, I get a letter in the mail. It's got his writing on it, thinking, praise God, he's going to say, okay, enough already. Stop with the damn checks. I open it up and it says, I just wanted to let you know my wife and I are having our second child and we're moving to another house and I wanted to give you our address so you could forward the checks there. I thought, damn, you know? And so every month took me 5.5 years to pay that money. And the last check I sent, I was able to send $100. And I never sent a card. I had to respect the fact he did not want to hear from me. Never sent a card, nothing with it, just a check. And at the bottom in the memo, I wrote, thank you. And I sent that last check. And I will tell you, I still don't like sand today, but I can look at sand, I can stand in sand, I can see a surfboard, and I don't have that feeling anymore. I've got that freedom from taking the contrary action and doing something I think has nothing to do with the way I feel, and I get the desired result. So anyway, so I do that ninth step, and I complete those ninth steps, and amazingly enough, I get those promises. You know the ones that say, no matter how far down the scale you have gone, you will see how your experience can benefit others? Those things that cause the most shame, the most demoralizing stuff that I did, I cannot tell you how many times I've had to pull those skeletons out of the closet to help somebody else. That those things which seem to be my worst liabilities have become my biggest assets today. That's the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. I proceeded to go ahead and get to a point by the time I was at step 10 where I was free. I was in that neutral place. I started to develop a relationship with a power greater than myself. And I was able to go ahead and honestly look at myself on a daily basis and admit when I'm wrong. And that practice of looking at myself on a daily basis and self-searching keeps me humble. I guess as humble as I could be, I suppose. And I moved on to step 11. And I started to improve on and nurture this relationship with a power greater than myself by doing prayer and meditation in the morning and asking that power to keep me sober, to direct my attention, to help me to help somebody else, to get out of self. They told me when I got here that the root of my problem was selfishness and self-centeredness. That it was surrounded by 1,000 forms of fear and self-delusion and self-seeking. The fact that my first thought is not about me today is a miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I continue to do that 11th step work on a daily basis. And I did, you know, moved into step 12. What this man told me was, he said, the only thing I ask is after 9 months, when we're done doing this, that you turn around and you do this with somebody else. And so from that time until this, I think it took me till about, gosh, I was almost 6 years sober. I was 5 years and 9 months sober. It took me till I was about 6 and a half, almost 7 years sober to complete this process with this man. And from that day until this, I'll be 22 years sober in December, I've done exactly that. I have sat down with someone one time a week at least. Sometimes I do two or three people at a week, you know, so sometimes I'm doing it two or three times a week. But I've sat down every week with somebody, and I've read through that big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, page by page, line by line, word by word, and I've walked through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous with another alcoholic. And I got exactly what step 12 promises me. I had a spiritual awakening, a change in my thinking sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism. I've had the opportunity to have that obsession removed from my head and to be able to differentiate the true from the false, to actually have thoughts of truth instead of thoughts of lies, and to know and to discern when the thoughts of a lie come in, to take action on the truth, and to thank the lie for sharing and move on to the appropriate action. But I've also had the opportunity that one of the 12-step promises tells me is I've been able to watch the light turn on in somebody else's eyes. I've been able to watch those chains of bondage fall off of other people and watch them find freedom, just like the freedom I found in Alcoholics Anonymous, by carrying the message. And most importantly, I've been able to practice the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, those principles like willingness and honesty, brotherly love and humility, integrity, consistency. You know, when I came here, they gave me one of these little tickets to get a mug. And, you know, you put your name on it, your sobriety date, and then you get to, like, pick a slogan. I'm like, oh, what slogan? There's 50 million of them on the list, you know. And you know what I came up with? Constant vigilance. Because I'll tell you that to this day, I still go to a meeting every day. I still work the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I still have a commitment. Oddly enough, I am now the greeter at my Sunday night meeting. And I do those things, and like I said, I have a sponsor. I sponsor a lot of women, and I want to thank some of the women who came tonight that I sponsor to support me. I do those things not because I'm a good person, not because I want to win a medal. I do those things because my life depends upon it. They gave me an analogy when I got here, and it was this. You're gonna go on a journey. You're going to be riding a bicycle on this journey. And you're going to want your bicycle to be finely tuned. And every time you think, oh, I don't need to go to a meeting, or I really don't want to clean up, I don't want to raise my hand to help clean up, or I could be 15 minutes late, no one will notice. I really don't need to keep my commitment, I'll just have somebody else fill it for me. Every time you get that thought of, I don't want to answer the phone, it's just that girl I sponsor. I'm too tired to call my sponsor. Anytime I get those thoughts, ask yourself, you know, which part of the bicycle are you willing to take the journey without? Are you willing to ride that long journey without a seat? How about without the pedals? Or maybe without the handlebars or the brakes? How about without the tires or the spokes? Maybe not the chain. What part of the bike do you want to ride without? I'll tell you that it makes the journey a lot better if the bike is all in one piece. Much more comfortable journey. And that's why I continue to do all the things I did when I first got here. Because if I don't, my journey gets really uncomfortable. So, you know, I'm here to tell you that I'm not completely free of restless, irritable, and discontent. But I know what to do now to find the ease and comfort that I so desperately sought in the bottom of a bottle when I feel that way. I know that if I go ahead and I clean house, trust God, and work with others, I get that relief like that. So if you're new or if you're not new and you have not had the experience of working all 12 of the steps as they're outlined in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I highly recommend that you find somebody who can do that with you, so that you can find that freedom. I'll end with this, because I always end with this, and once again, I'd like to thank the committee for asking me to come here tonight. In my first 30 days of sobriety, we went to a lot of meetings, and one of the meetings that I was at, there was a man there, and he was sharing from the podium, and he said, "We don't promise you that if you come to Alcoholics Anonymous, the gates of heaven will open and they'll let you in. But we do promise you, and I promise you, that if you come to Alcoholics Anonymous and you stay sober one day at a time, the gates of hell will open and they'll let you out." And that has truly been my experience. I don't live in hell anymore. I don't live in that bondage of self. I found that utopia that they talk about in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, that heaven on earth, that peace within myself. My skin has been on the right way for a long, long time. And I have self-esteem today because I do esteemable things. And it's just as simple as that. I take the journey on a full, complete bicycle. And I urge you to do the same. Thank you.